This time on your weekly constitutional.
We're talking about a ruling from the Federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that impacts Tennessee law. Tennessee law states that punitive damages should have a cap on it. And the federal appellate court has basically said that this is now unconstitutional. This may have far-ranging impacts upon the tort reform movement in general.
That was Tony Seaton, a personal injury lawyer from Johnson City, Tennessee, talking about the federal court decision that recently declared Tennessee's limitation on tort liability unconstitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and this week it's about messing with Tennessee torts.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Over the past several decades, state legislatures have enacted a number of statutes that restrict the rights of plaintiffs to recover from defendants in civil lawsuits. This is generally called tort reform, although its opponents will hasten to add that they think of it more as tort deform. One statute in Tennessee that limits such plaintiffs from the damages they can receive was recently struck down as violative of the Tennessee Constitution. So it's an important issue of Tennessee constitutional law. Further complicating the situation, however, was that it was a federal court that did so. I became aware of this decision when my good friend Tony Seaton of Johnson City, Tennessee, sent me an email and said that this decision is causing quite a stir. Tony, thanks for coming in. It's always a pleasure to see you.
It's always glad to be here.
Thanks so much for that email, too, because, man, this case has the potential of being a blockbuster, doesn't it?
No question about it. You know, we've seen it on the listservs of lawyers across the state because it's such a powerful opinion.
It sure is, and as we'll discuss later, it may have ramifications all over the nation. But let's start at the beginning. Tell us about this case.
Essentially, as you said in the introduction, the Tennessee legislature has decided to place certain caps on damages. Their philosophy is that you don't want runaway juries, so therefore you should be able to place caps on damages, when someone files a lawsuit in civil court. So there's caps on compensatory damages, there's caps on medical malpractice damages, and there's caps on punitive damages.
So the two basic types of damages are compensatory, which means that if I'm injured and I incur expenses, whether they are medical expenses or pain and suffering or whatever, all of that is to compensate me for what I've suffered. But then on top of compensatory damages, there are so-called punitive damages, which in cases of particularly egregious conduct by the defendant are imposed actually to punish that defendant and to deter both that defendant and other defendants in the future from engaging in the same sort of conduct, right?
Yeah, that's an excellent explanation of that. Not all cases have punitive damages. Punitive damages, as you say, are for egregious, for intentional, fraudulent, malicious, or reckless type of conduct. And so only after a jury comes back and says, we're giving compensatory damages and elects to do punitive damages, would you get those types of damages.
Okay, so that's extremely important for us to understand the difference.
Right.
And also, as you say, to mention that this is something that juries decide. Okay, so the actual group of 6 or 12 citizens that sit and listen to all the evidence first has to decide how much the plaintiff has been injured. Well, first has to decide whether there is, actual liability by the defendant.
Yeah, or wrongdoing.
Okay, so they decide that case and they say, okay, the defendant has to pay something. Then they decide the amount of compensatories. Then, only in appropriate cases, and that's a small percentage of them, do they decide that they want to impose punitives on top of that. Now, all of that through the common law was done by juries, also judges. Okay, judges can weigh in on these things. But juries are extremely important in British and American history. They are protected by both the federal constitution and the 7th Amendment and by, I'm guessing, all 50 state constitutions. Juries are important because they involve citizens in the legal process, because they take some power away from judges and thereby further divide governmental power. And they also provide a political check in politically charged cases, giving the people a direct say in some of these civil cases, as well as criminal cases. So juries are very important, and we need to keep that in mind as we go forward. So, okay, we've got this case.
Well, but, and as a matter of fact, let me go just a step further with you. You know, our country was founded upon one of the rights to trial by jury. I mean, that was one of the, you know, First Amendments that we came up with. You know, we did not want judges politically appointed or corporate people or rich people or white people or anything else making those decisions. We wanted a jury of peers, of people in the community making those decisions. And that's been a very, very important process to our
extremely important. In fact, we could talk about this forever.
Sure.
One of the big cases that came up even before we were a country, back in the days when we were colonies, was the Peter Zenger case up in the state of New York. That was the case where the government sued a fellow named Zenger for criminal libel, and the jury refused to find him liable. The jury was composed of local citizens of the colony, whereas the judge was appointed by the crown. So this was very much perceived at the time and subsequently as a very political check on the power of the central government. So juries are important. This idea, though, that juries should be somehow restricted in what they can do, and that's what we call tort reform. Could you talk a little bit about that generally? Why do you think that state legislatures are trying to limit the ability of the people who are actually in the room and hear the case to give the award they think is appropriate?
Well, it's been an interesting movement, and it's been a movement that's been going on for probably about 25 or 30 years, where they have decided that instead of allowing juries to come up with whatever numbers that they want, they felt like, well, wait a minute, you're getting some runaway juries. A lot of times, you know, one of the things that they like to bring up is the McDonald's coffee case. Everybody's familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Woman spilled coffee in her lap, and there were, you know, I don't remember what the verdict was, but it was in the millions of dollars. And they said, no, we can't have that. We've got to put a limit or a cap upon those things. And so that's what actually happened in 2011. The Tennessee legislature came up with this Tennessee Tort Reform Act.
There's a wonderful documentary out there called Hot Coffee.
Yes.
I'm sure you've seen it.
I have.
And it basically says that what you've just said is a lie. Okay, now you're not lying.
Sure.
You're reflecting what the tort reformers are saying. Mm-hmm. The entire narrative that this woman somehow got this bonanza from spilling a little bit of coffee on her lap is a gross distortion of what happened. McDonald's had been told for years that its coffee was too hot, that people were really burning their mouths with it or spilling it on themselves and burning other parts of their bodies. And in this one circumstance, this woman is at a drive-in and someone hands her the coffee and it spills on her lap, and she's not in a position to get out of the car immediately. She can't get her clothes away from her body, and you can actually see the pictures. This woman suffered horrible burns to her body.
Yes.
And McDonald's had not been willing to change its ways. And so there was a significant award in that case of punitive damages to get McDonald's attention. And even though it was a significant amount of money, it was basically what McDonald's earns. It really was not that big a percentage of McDonald's profits in any given year, but it did get their attention. Unfortunately, it also got the attention of tort reformers who used that and other cases, oftentimes distorted, to justify taking this power away from juries. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a matter of fact, it goes back to the whole purpose of tort law. Tort mm-hmm. law goes back way before this country was founded. And it's not just to compensate victims. It's also to provide safety. It's also to deter others from wrongful conduct. And that's what we're losing with the tort reform movement. It's like they think it's all about compensation. No, it's not. It's also about punishing wrongdoers and making certain that we have a safe society.
And that's why we have a lot of laws, and that's why we have warnings and warning labels, and that's why we have business owners making sure that they keep their sidewalks cleaned off when it snows or when it's dangerous outside, because otherwise they know that they might be subject to some sort of tort liability. Okay, So now that we know what tort reform is, and now that we know that the Tennessee legislature's done it, can we talk specifically about the Tennessee statute? What did they specifically limit here? What was the statute in question?
Well, there were quite a few things, and not only in the tort reform statute, but there was another statute called the Healthcare Liability Act. But they all limit what we call non-economic damages to $750,000. So you gave the example a minute ago when someone gets hurt, they have a certain amount of medical bills, they have lost wages and things like that, things that you can actually put on a spreadsheet versus the non-economic, which would be the pain and suffering, the loss of value, the disfigurement, things like that, that you can't really put a number on. So they're saying that the maximum that anybody should ever get would be $750,000. And that even applies in a death claim. It applies in a medical malpractice claim. So that's kind of hard to fathom that someone's life might be worth only $750,000, or someone's care that they may need for the rest of their life would only be worth $750,000.
Or just the pain that they feel on a daily basis and the disruption of their life and all the rest of it. And again, it's taking away the decision from the people in the room who actually
right.
see the pain and the suffering
right.
and putting it in the hands of a legislature sitting over in Nashville or some other state capital. And moreover, these amounts are not indexed, are they?
Correct.
I mean, so it's $750,000 from the point where the statute's adopted, and then inflation is not taken into account as time goes by, is it?
Correct.
Oh, my goodness gracious. All right, so that's the statute in question. Talk about this case, though. What was this particular case about? I mean, it involves several different states you mentioned, but what's it about?
Well, you're talking about the Lindenberg case.
Lindenberg yeah. case. And what is for all the lawyers, and where did this case arise, and what was it about?
Okay. This case was originally brought in the western section of the state of Tennessee in a federal court in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And basically what they were contesting was whether or not someone should have gotten life insurance. And so they filed the lawsuit for the life insurance, and then they said, but the life insurance company was also not doing what they needed to do, and in bad faith, they denied the claim. So in other words, they didn't pay the claim like they should have done. Well, there's a statute that says, well, there's, you can get a 25% penalty, but in this case, they said, no, we should get punitive damages also. And so the jury came back and awarded a significant amount of money for the punitive damages, but with a cap on punitive damages by way of the Tennessee statute, the district court cut that back. So it goes up to the Sixth Circuit.
Before we leave that, I just want to make sure I understand. Someone dies.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a life insurance policy.
Right.
Makes a claim. The life insurance company doesn't pay the claim. The jury determines they should have paid the claim, and also determines that the insurance company acted in bad faith.
Right.
And that was the basis for the punitive damages. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is my buddy, Tony Seaton, a lawyer from Johnson City, Tennessee, who's telling us about a recent federal court decision that declared a Tennessee statute unconstitutional. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today with me is Tony Seaton, a lawyer from Johnson City, Tennessee, who is a personal injury lawyer much of the time, and he recently brought to my attention a fascinating new case called Lindenberg versus Jackson National Life Insurance Company that arose out of Memphis, Tennessee, and involved a life insurance claim that was not only denied, it was denied in bad faith and resulted in a very significant jury award, and a jury award that ran smack into a Tennessee statute. How much did the jury award in this case, Tony, for punitive damages?
They awarded $3
million. $3 million. Mm-hmm. So the jury that was in the room, that listened to all the testimony, decided that this company had acted so egregiously that it needed to pay $3 million just to punish that company and to deter its such conduct in the future.
Correct.
This must have been pretty egregious facts here.
I think so. Uh-huh. I mean, obviously the jury felt so.
You're a PI lawyer. I mean, what sort of facts do you need to get a $3 million punitive award in this case? I mean, what do you have to be able to show?
Again, this was in the life insurance arena. So, I mean, you have some life insurance company that is just not listening to the facts and saying, we're not going to award this no matter what. And so if it rises to the level of fraudulent or intentional or malicious or something like that, then a jury can come back and say, wait a minute, we think this is egregious, and we think that there should be not only the amount of the life insurance policy should be paid, but punitive damages should be paid in addition.
This happens all too frequently in the insurance business. In fact, I was aware of a case some years ago, 20, 30 years ago, in another state that involves so-called credit life insurance, mm-hmm. which is basically a rip-off product to begin with. It's not worth what you pay for it. When you go and buy a car, and they will say at the very end when they're trying to tack on all those extra fees at the dealership, oh, sure. Wouldn't you like to pay 15 more bucks a month, and then your car will be paid off if you die? Well, that's expensive. It's much cheaper just to buy term life insurance, and moreover, it gets less and less valuable with time as the value of the car goes down, as the balance of the loan goes down. So it's a bad product to begin with. It's sold under high-pressure circumstances, and there was this one company that just had a policy of denying all claims. The claims would be filed, deny. Appeal, deny, all the rest of it. And their theory was that these are relatively small claims, and we're just going to deny them, and people will go away. Well, that's exactly what happened to them. A few of these cases, the lawyers stuck with them, and they showed a pattern of this sort of misconduct. And so these eventually, they resulted in the bankruptcy of the company because they were acting consistently in bad faith. And so that's the reason that you have these sorts of punitive damages award, is to punish and deter that sort of behavior.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a matter of fact, punitive damages goes back to the late 1700s.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. There are North Carolina cases that talk about punitive damages. North Carolina was what we based our Constitution upon, you know, back in the late 1700s.
Yeah, Tennessee used to be mm-hmm. part of North Carolina, or at least
correct.
Tennessee was claimed by North Carolina.
Correct.
And then eventually was formed out of that territory. So we trace our constitutional history back to them. Okay, so we've got a provision in our Tennessee Constitution that the plaintiffs in this case used to challenge this tort reform statute. What was that provision?
There's a provision in the Constitution, I think it's Article 1, Section 6, that says that the right to a trial by jury in this state shall remain inviolate. And that's some of the strongest language that any state constitution uses. The right to a trial by jury shall remain inviolate. Inviolate basically meaning it shall not be disturbed. And so that should give someone the right to not only allow a jury to determine whether or not there's a wrongdoer and whether they've done something wrong, but it should also allow the jury to determine the damages, if any, they should collect.
My. Okay. Well, then restating it differently, this Tennessee Constitution so strongly supports a right to trial by jury that any reduction, especially an arbitrary one where you say you can't have more than this number of dollars, imposed by a legislature, is taking away too much power from the jury.
Correct. And the Tennessee legislature came up with the Tennessee Tort Reform Act back in 2011. It's never been challenged. It was somewhat challenged in the state at one point in time, but it was done so before a jury had come back with a verdict. And so they said that the issue was not ripe. They sent it back and said, we're not going to determine that now. But as of now, the Tennessee Supreme Court has never ruled upon the constitutionality of these limitations on damages.
We'll get to that issue in just a second. But in the meantime, let's focus on this and in its practical effect. You now have a court decision from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that says that the Tennessee limitation on punitive damages is unconstitutional under the Tennessee Constitution. How does that affect your practice as a personal injury lawyer?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as we talked about earlier, not all cases have punitive damage elements. It's
right.
Only the most egregious cases. But if I can go to federal court now, that's where I would go. You know, we can file cases either in state court or in federal court, only in federal court if there are different citizens of states, because that's what right. We call diversity jurisdiction.
Okay. And this might also be influential in other states as well, because other states have similar, maybe not quite as strongly worded provisions in their state constitutions. I wonder if other states might look to this Sixth Circuit opinion and change their interpretations of their laws as well.
Could be, especially the ones that have the strong language saying that the right to a trial by jury shall remain inviolate.
Okay. So to summarize then, this might be a very significant decision, not just for Tennessee lawyers and litigants, but for litigants and lawyers from other states as well. And it may ultimately undermine the very concept of limitations of damages in so-called tort reform statutes.
Yeah, not only that, but see, since the 2011 Legislative Act limiting damages has not been ruled upon by the Tennessee Supreme Court, it's probably going to put a lot of pressure on some pressure on the Tennessee Supreme Court to go ahead and rule on that issue when it's brought up to them.
Let's talk about that issue right now, the question of state versus federal courts.
Okay.
In fact, now I have to go back and do my civil procedure professor thing.
Yep.
Starting point for this discussion is that we have two basic different court systems in the United States. We've got the federal court system that has trial courts and appellate courts, and at the very top of the pyramid, the United States Supreme Court. And then we've got a group of 50 state court systems. Sometimes we'd like to say we have 51 court systems in this country, but for our purposes, we're simply saying federal on the one side, state on the other. And this is part of our federal constitution. The concept of federalism is that you have two different governments simultaneously ruling over the same geographic territory. So, for example, we're sitting in the state of Tennessee now. We're subject to all of the laws of Tennessee. If we violate those laws, we might be brought into Tennessee court and we might be punished by one of those courts, civilly or criminally. At the same time, we're sitting in the United States of America, and if we violate a federal statute, we might be dragged into a federal court, we might be prosecuted or sued, and we might be penalized in that court. Now, this obviously creates a tension, and we call that tension federalism. And it exists throughout the government, but it certainly also exists within the judiciary. And so judges in the federal system and judges in the state system are always at pains to respect one another.
Correct.
To engage in something that's often called comity,
mm-hmm.
with a T. Federal judges especially, I think, are very much aware that since federal law is generally superior to or supreme, they don't want to step on the toes of state courts. So let's go a little bit more. This is getting a little bit complicated. There is a particular type of overlap in the power of the state and federal courts, something we call jurisdiction, which says that while state courts can hear state law cases and, to a great extent, are the final authority on state law issues, federal courts can also occasionally hear cases involving state law issues. In fact, frequently can hear them because of something you just mentioned, federal diversity jurisdiction. So if I, sitting in the state of Tennessee, want to sue Joe Blow in the state of Virginia, we might very well go to federal court rather than state court, which might provide a more neutral forum for our interstate dispute. But ultimately, pursuant to something, I really am getting down in the weeds here, something called the Erie Doctrine, which all the lawyers listening know about, if we are in federal court because of this so-called diversity jurisdiction, hearing state law claims, we can't just make up things. We have to point to some state's law and apply that state's law. So that's what happened here. You had litigants from several different states. Their case was being heard in federal court in the Western District of the state of Tennessee, but this federal court was applying Tennessee law in this diversity case. Did I state that all correctly?
Yeah, let me take a little stab at that too.
Sure.
Because, you know, basically if you lived in Washington County and Joe Blow lived in Carter County and you all had a car wreck, that case can't be heard anywhere but in state court.
Right.
But if Joe Blow lived in Abington, then and you have the car wreck, whether it's in Abington or whether it's in Johnson City, then you can bring the case either in state court or you can bring it in federal court based upon the fact that you're citizens of different states.
And because you live in Johnson City, only a few miles from the Virginia border, you probably get those sorts of cases all the time, don't
you? Oh, sure, absolutely.
So these diversity cases are actually quite common. And this issue of which state's law a federal court sitting in diversity should hear is a big area, federal constitutional law. In this case, the federal court decided that Tennessee law was applicable. And normally speaking, a federal court or federal judge hearing such a case can simply look at the Tennessee law and follow the Tennessee precedents And especially if there's a Tennessee Supreme Court opinion that's on point, follow that opinion and everything's simpatico. The federal court has given full respect, full comity to the Tennessee law and the Tennessee court systems. Everyone's happy. But in this case, as you have hinted a couple of times, this particular Tennessee law had not been challenged. At least no challenges had reached the Tennessee Supreme Court. So what's the federal judge supposed to do?
Well, the federal judge actually has a procedure if they want to, or even the Court of Appeals has a procedure, the Federal Court of Appeals, to certify. In other words, to say, we haven't found an opinion by the Tennessee Supreme Court, so we want to certify that opinion, send it to the Supreme Court, let them decide it, and then we will apply it. Mm-hmm. And that was brought out in this Lindenberg opinion that they didn't do that.
They didn't do it because they also have the option.
Correct.
Of simply trying to speculate on what the Tennessee Supreme Court would do.
Right.
And that's the option they chose.
Right.
Wow. What do you think about that, Tony?
Well, it's going to be interesting because, it's going to have an impact upon the Tennessee Supreme Court. It's not going to go any further in the federal system. I can't imagine it getting to the U.S. Supreme Court because that's so rare that it gets there. But it's going to have such an impact because we're saying that maybe the Tennessee Supreme Court is going to follow exactly what the Sixth Circuit has done.
Wow. Okay. So normally speaking, and perhaps ideally in a federal system, this issue would have been resolved already within the state of Tennessee, and the federal court would simply be applying Tennessee law.
Right.
But because this issue has not been definitively decided by the Tennessee Supreme Court, the federal court had the choice of either guessing at what Tennessee Supreme Court would do or, as you say, certifying a question, literally writing a letter to the Tennessee Supreme Court and saying, hey, guys, we've got this issue. Could you please resolve it for us? Send it back here to us. Then we'll apply your decision. Well, the downside to that, of course, is that it might take months, years.
Sure.
For the Tennessee Supreme Court's under no obligation to decide that case in a timely fashion. And my understanding is, in fact, some state Supreme Courts are not very responsive at all to certified questions. But this federal appeals court decided to take the other route and simply take its best guess as to what Tennessee law would be if it went all the way to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And to come back to your comment, you think that maybe then the federal Sixth Circuit ruling on Tennessee law may pressure the Tennessee Supreme Court to take an appropriate case to decide this issue and may indeed influence the Tennessee Supreme Court to decide it the same way.
Correct, because see, the federal opinion from the Court of Appeals is binding in federal court, but that's not necessarily binding in state court.
Isn't that the strangest thing, yep. Tony? It really is. I mean, this really is a federalism issue. It's a very constitutional issue, and that goes back to something else you've said. If you get a case like this, and if there's a basis for federal jurisdiction, for federal diversity jurisdiction, you're going to federal court.
Right.
Because that's where you can get all your punitives.
Right.
For your plaintiffs. If you don't have that basis, you go to state court and you don't know whether that state statute is going to limit your punitives or not.
Right.
In the first instance, it will, but you might then be able to appeal it to the Tennessee Supreme Court.
But again, assuming that I've got a case that I can get into federal court with different citizens.
Right. Wow. Well, what has been the reaction among Tennessee lawyers to this particular decision?
Well, it's been elation.
Elation among the plaintiffs, among the defendants. Plaintiffs.
That's correct.
Right.
But because we've said it all along. I mean, if you read the Tennessee Constitution where it says that the right to a trial by jury shall remain inviolate, that's not hard language to interpret.
Right.
And we've said it all along. You can't cap these types of damages. That flies in the face of what the Constitution says. But, you know, again, I defer to the Tennessee Supreme Court. That's their job. It's not my job. They're the referees. They're the ones that calls the balls and the strikes. And they generally do a pretty good job at it.
You know, here's a really interesting thought that just occurred to me. We normally think of diversity jurisdiction, where you've got litigants from two different states, as being a way for them to find a neutral forum so that everybody will be treated fairly. I wonder if we've got a different thing going on here. Tennessee judges, and I say this with all due respect, are elected and for fixed terms, and therefore come under scrutiny from the public every few years. And certainly being human beings who want to keep their jobs might feel pressure to hold in a certain way. Otherwise, they might be targeted when they're up for re-election down the road. So if I'm a Tennessee Supreme Court justice, I might be kind of reluctant to overrule a Tennessee statute on the basis of the Tennessee Constitution. But a federal judge sitting on the Sixth Circuit has a lifetime appointment and has no particular reason to hold one way or the other when interpreting Tennessee law. So maybe this is an example of a federal court doing something that's important that would otherwise not happen within the state court system.
You know, that's a great point. Because if you go back through the history of this thing, the Tennessee Tort Reform Act was passed in 2011. Mm-hmm. There was a retention election for the Tennessee Supreme Court in 2014 where three of our justices were up for, you know, where they say yes or no, yes, you will be retained or no, you will not be. And the lieutenant governor of the state of Tennessee decided to get involved in that and try to oppose the three justices. So they, at that point in time, they were pretty sensitive to what the legislature was putting out. And we had a supermajority in the Tennessee state legislature.
That, to me, is a really interesting point because federal judges can come into a circumstance, they can do the research, and maybe in the back of the minds, I can't read minds, maybe in the back of the minds of the two-judge majority in this particular case, they were thinking to themselves, we can do things here more easily than the Tennessee Supreme Court can do. We really want to uphold this Tennessee constitutional provision because we do think inviolate means inviolate. And maybe Tennessee Supreme Court doesn't feel like it has the same ability to do that. And therefore, we're going to step in and help out the people of Tennessee in interpreting their Constitution. Now, that sounds very paternalistic, but I'm wondering if maybe that was part of the motivation here for not certifying the question.
Well, they did try to certify the question. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the things that the dissent said in the opinion was that they did try to certify the questions, and the Supreme Court said that they would be amenable to them certifying the questions, but then these appellate judges decided to go ahead and make the decision anyway.
So they'd actually begun the process of certifying this opinion. Well, that makes me wonder even more.
Oh, I know
what these two judges and the majority of the Sixth Circuit opinion were thinking, but of course we'll probably never know that.
That's right, and the opinion is actually for publication, so there's more. That gives it a little bit more impact than one that's not for publication.
Well, Tony, this has been absolutely fascinating. We've talked about both the significance of this for tort reform and its significance within our federal system of government. I hope we haven't gotten too wonkish here, but we've got to do a little bit of explanation of this. Any thoughts, any final thoughts on the significance of this case before we wrap this up?
Well, you know, my thought is if, in fact, ultimately, the cap on punitive damages is eroded, done away with, then it certainly makes all the other caps on damages, because there's different statutes that cap damages. It may make all of those suspect. So it could have far and wide-ranging effects.
This is radio. People can't see you, but I see a twitching of smiling as you say that. Maybe this is the harbinger of the end of tort reform in Tennessee, and as we've said, perhaps some other states as well.
Well, you know, the tort reform issue, I mean, I see it from both sides. I grew up in business all my life, and I understand, you know, folks want to quantify what you can get from a jury or from a court system. But then again, it's so hard to quantify bad conduct. And there again, I say that there's different reasons for torts other than compensation. It's also to deter bad conduct and to make things safe.
I will go even further, Tony, and say that laws can never anticipate every circumstance.
Right.
That's why we have courts.
Right.
I mean, if we could anticipate in advance exactly each circumstance, we just pass a law and then we have computers that could apply the law to individual cases.
Right.
But we can't. We have judges and we have juries for that purpose, and this is the decision that says that's what these juries are for, and we're going to let them do their jobs. So thank you very much for your time. Okay. We appreciate it, and next time another decision comes up of this sort, you're going to send us another email?
Absolutely.
Thanks, Tony.
Great. Thank you.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just finished a really interesting discussion with my good buddy Tony Seaton, a personal injury lawyer in Johnson City, Tennessee, about a recent case that may change the landscape for so-called tort reform. After the break, we'll have a change of pace. We'll go back and talk to one of our buddies at Montpelier about conservation. Stick around. And now it's time to spend a few minutes with Kat Imhoff, the president of Montpelier, who's going to tell us all about her efforts to conserve Montpelier's 2,700 acres.
Welcome back, Kat.
Thank you, Stuart. Happy to be here again.
It's always a pleasure to see you. And I understand that this time you have something very dirty to talk about.
Well, I do. Uh-huh. I wouldn't put it exactly that way. I think more, let's get in touch with our natural side here
at Montpelier.
Is that
what it is? We're talking about ground, though, aren't we?
We are. Well, we're talking about birds and bunnies and ground and grass and trees and all kinds of things.
And what lawyers call easements.
Conservation easements, yes.
Why is the president of Montpelier talking to me about conservation easements?
Well, I might lead into it. We've been actually thinking about this as the year of the three C's. So we focused, and you and I have had conversations before about one of the C's, and that's about challenging conversations. You know, what do we do here at Montpelier? Talk about Madison, legacy of slavery, and all kinds of really intriguing things. That's been our one C. Then another C, of course, has been the Constitution itself. And we're spending a lot of time on constitutional relevance and what we as Americans want. But the third C, I think, has surprised people in that we've come out of the gates very strong, though admittedly have always been working in this area, but really focusing on conservation.
Well, you do have a lot of land, don't you?
We do, a little under 2,700 acres. We kind of rounded up to 2,700 acres. Of course, Madison in his time had 5,000 acres, but today we are lucky to have the 2,700. And that's a lot of land to kind of use and make accessible. And we've thought a lot about what should that land look like 100 years from now.
Yeah, that's really striking to me is that even though it is only a little over half the size of Madison's original acreage, there's still so much of it, and it's still so well situated that from the mansion itself, pretty much everywhere you look, you're looking at Montpelier property. And the view shed, as you like to call it, is at least seems to me to be almost pristine.
Well, we're really lucky, and I think this is something we think about a lot. You know, 200 years from now, when you're a visitor standing on the front porch of Montpelier looking towards the Blue Ridge, you're going to still see the same view.
Right.
And that's because we do own most of what's in our close view here. But, you know, you worry about what the future will bring, and that's what's led us to think about some permanent land protection. We have the 2,700 acres, and several years ago, people here at Montpelier started thinking about what would perpetuity look like, and they started putting some land under permanent protection. What we mean by a conservation easement is making it so that in the future it would not be developed. You could still use it for trails, you would manage the forest, it could be used for agricultural. There are some other passive uses on the property, but they went ahead a couple of years ago and put about 915 acres under easement.
But at the risk of sounding like a wonky pedant, I will simply explain what an easement is.
Oh, please do.
And an easement is an interest in land. In fact, property law, the ownership of property is often described as a bundle of rights. And if you, most people, what they think of when they think of property ownership is something lawyers will call fee simple, which means that you have basically every right you can have in property. And that's subject only to the power of the sovereign to come and take it from you through something called a condemnation. And that does happen occasionally. And the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution says that even though the government can do that, if it has to build a road or something, that it has to compensate you for it. But with that one caveat, fee simple ownership means that that land is yours. I guess one other limitation on it would be that you have to pay taxes on it. And if you don't pay your taxes, then eventually you might lose your property too. But with those two caveats, both of which involve that overreaching government of ours, you own the property. But you can own lesser interests in property too. And so, for example, if you own something in fee simple, that's Kat Imhoff's property, and I want to build a road over it, and we agree upon that, then you can sell me an easement. That is the right to build a road for a particular purpose, maybe for a period of years, maybe in perpetuity, but I have the right to use your property for some purpose.
Well, and that's great with the right-of-way easement. And I think to your point, we're giving up some of the sticks in our bundle. And in particular, the one that worries people the most is Would you subdivide? Would you do like a large lot residential development? And that has happened on some historic sites when situations where people have gotten short on funds. We want to make sure that at Montpelier, we don't do that. And so we are giving up some of our sticks in the bundle of property rights.
Very well said. But here's my question, though, and this is essentially what you're saying is, you want to limit the options of future boards of Montpelier. So the board of 2018 is reaching out its cold, dead hand 100, 200, 300 years in the future and is going to say, thou shalt not subdivide Montpelier. Montpelier will stay this way forever.
I think that's exactly right. And what we're recognizing here is one of the most important contributions maybe we can make, not only in preserving Madison's intellectual heritage, but really preserving physically the place and the setting for Montpelier. When you think about where Montpelier is located, we're here in the Virginia Piedmont. We happen to sit also in two rural historic districts. We're in the Madison Barber Rural Historic District, which abuts the Southwest Mountains Rural Historic Districts. This all sounds very theoretical, but it's an amazing intact landscape. We want to be contributing to that intact landscape 100 years from now. And you were also situated on Route 20 called Madison Highway. Mm-hmm. It's a Virginia byway. Close by, we have Route 22 and 231, also Virginia byways. And we're part of the Journey Through Hallowed Ground landscape, which is a national heritage area that links Gettysburg to our best friend's house, Thomas Jefferson, down the road. And we're right in the center of that. So I think it's really important for a place like Montpelier to not only be part of the intellectual heritage and saving that and preserving that and promoting that for future generations, but also to be part of saving the very landscape and fabric of the Virginia Piedmont.
Absolutely. And it is a gorgeous area. To whom are you granting, or to which entities are you granting these easements?
Well, lest we forget, we are a National Trust site. So this property does belong to the National Trust. So the easement will actually be the National Trust filing a conservation easement, and the holder of the easement or the enforcer of the easement will be the Piedmont Environmental Council, which is a regional nonprofit focused on land conservation and other conservation issues.
So 100 years from now, when a less enlightened board might be in charge of Montpelier, they will say, hey, why don't we just subdivide and build a few McMansions out here? And then the environmental group will say, you cannot violate our conservation easement. So basically, as you say, it's an outside enforcer.
Right. And when somebody asked me a while ago, when I first took this job 6 years ago, what was I really hoping to accomplish here? And so much of it, we've been able to kind of move the ball forward. And part of it was to bring Mr. Madison back to the house, which has been the really fully fill out the rooms, really bring the furniture mm-hmm. and the color and all of the objects back so you can tell this story and people can kind of see and envision that life of James and Dolly. Another part of it was to tell a more complete story, meaning, the 300 people and generations of folks who were enslaved here at Montpelier, and we continue to work on that and move that forward. But another part from the beginning was, what could we do to make sure that this property was really safe for future generations in a very tangible, concrete. So this conservation easement's always been on my mind for the last 6 years. One of the other parts of this is I always worry about, do people have access to open space? I mean, we really know from the studies that kids are benefited, families are benefited, all of us are benefited by walking through the woods, by being outside. So 6 years ago, we also made it free to come on the property. You still buy a ticket if you want to tour the house and the mirror distinction of color. But we've now made this property open for the public, and we have 8 miles of trails. We connect to Graylin, which is our next-door neighbor in this amazing nursery, beautiful views. And that's been a very important part to us as well, being part of the community, of really serving as a regional park and allowing people to have opportunities to be on the site. I think that's a very important part as well of this conservation story. For the most part, conservation easements are on properties that are privately held. So you and I may enjoy them very much because we see them while driving by in our car and they're beautiful. That open space, that view is protected. We get benefits because there's better water quality coming off these properties. We get benefits because there's habitat for wildlife. but we don't typically get to walk on them. And that's going to be a difference as well with this conservation easement, which we hope will be an additional 1,000 acres or so on the property. We haven't surveyed it, so you never know till you get on the ground really what you've got. And our aim is to have that easement recorded by sometime this spring. So we're really at the beginning of that process right now. But for me, an important part of this entire message is let's do conservation not only for the birds and the bunnies and the red-headed woodpecker, but also to really make sure 100 years from now there's places for people to walk and enjoy open space.
I'm reminded of another historic site that I had the pleasure of visiting several years ago, and that's Winston Churchill's home, Chartwell. And Chartwell, I don't know the legalities of it over there, but I suspect something similar is afoot, because when you go to Chartwell, you see lots of people just there picnicking. He has a couple of beautiful ponds that he built on Chartwell's property, and although I was there as a tourist, those other people were just there recreating. And so that's what you see here at Montpelier, is the same thing. Just families having a good time, and then other people who are more for the history and the Constitution.
Well, and as a visitor, you know, we, as you said, we all go different places, right, as tourists and visitors. I find I want a multiple experience. I want different angles. I want to and have be educated. I want to be entertained. I want to be kind of entranced and pulled into the story. But I also might want to drink a glass of wine, have a really good barbecue sandwich, have a place to stop by with a wonderful nursery. And that's also why, as part of this conservation work, we have teamed up with our neighbors and have formed something called the Virginia Foothills, so that we're a tourism destination. Yes, come enjoy our open space. Come, you know, be walk deeply into history with us. But also go to Graylin, go to Willow Grove Inn, eat barbecue at the Barbecue Exchange, and visit the Barbersville Vineyard. So we see conservation not solely just for itself, but also as part of being in this community. We want to be a community and regional asset, a place where you come and do many things. You have the historic moment, but you also have that chance to walk, to enjoy a great bottle of wine. So it's kind of all part and parcel. I also tend to think, I mentioned before, our first easement here is one that we're very proud of, and it's with the Nature Conservancy. So in this case, the group that's making sure to keep an eye on us and that we're treating the land properly, in this case, is the Virginia chapter of the Nature Conservancy. But 200 acres of an old-growth forest were put under easement many years ago, and that was Madison's landmark forest. It's a pretty phenomenal piece of land, and it's been written about in several different places, but I think Andrea Wolf in her book, Founding Farmers, really put her finger on it, in that Madison was looking so far ahead and thinking about what was happening in this country. She really calls him the father, or the early father, of conservation, which may be pushing, you know, the envelope a little bit, but he was, along with a couple of other of his contemporaries, very worried about what he saw happening in Virginia in his lifetime. He saw incredible soil depletion. He wrote a lot about trying to save the soils, adding manures to it, doing planting crops like red clover. He's also one of the first, along with Thomas Jefferson, to really be focusing on plowing correctly. You know, plowing with the, you know, with the slope, not you know, kind of up and down the hills, but contour plowing, which seems so obvious to us today, but was not the practice then. And he thought and wrote a lot about the loss of the forest lands. You know, before. He was really one of the first people to say to all of his contemporaries, and he did it so eloquently in an address in 1818 to the Albemarle Agricultural Society, which sounds so quaint now, but was actually a really important document. But he calls out a warning that we really could lose all the great woodlands of Virginia and of actually of the United States at that time, and he puts aside 200 acres, which is now why we have this tremendous old-growth forest that you can walk into. And you can tell immediately, in being in those woods, that it is a different place. And we have a lot of birders who come because there's some species of birds that you don't see anywhere else or are hard to find, including the red-headed woodpecker is one of the particular ones for people's birds list. But I just think this is so amazingly part of the story that Madison is worrying about this 200-plus years ago. We've been working also to take some of the fields that over time, as Madison would approve of, have gotten sort of depleted in their soils. So we're very systematically trying to put in Virginia warm season grasses, putting in a lot of wildflowers, so you come out in different seasons, some of the fields can be just beautiful. And we've seen a real marked increase in our wildlife on property, including black bear moving through the property at times, a really lovely hawk population. We have two sets of Red Fox that are on the property right now. So it's just another kind of layer to what makes Montpelier so special.
The soil was depleted because this was a tobacco farm. Mm-hmm. And I was once talking to Matt Reeves about this and talking about, you know, the inherent issue of to what extent do you preserve from other eras, from the DuPont era, for example, and the horse aspect of Montpelier. And I said, Matt, did it ever occur to you that it would, you know, the ultimate authenticity would be to restore essentially a few hundred acres of tobacco out here? And that has obvious moral implications, and it has makes people a little bit uneasy as well. He said he didn't think that was ever going to happen, at least not on his watch, because he wanted, if he said if he was going to have some agricultural products out there, he would want to have products that were products that people could actually come here and help grow as part of their experience, and maybe the sort of things that the enslaved community would have grown to feed itself.
Yeah, actually, we're planning on recreating some of the smaller vegetable gardens.
So those plans are advanced.
Those plans are working, going forward. That will, some of that will occur in the South Yard. And we've been thinking a lot about the Gilmore Cabin, which, of course, is George Gilmore, who was a freedman, created that cabin. We've had a working garden over there and thinking more about expanding that with heritage plants. But tobacco is a great story because it was so soil depleting.
Yes.
Madison grew a lot of it off and on over the years. There's only one time period that we can see for the records when price was so low on it that he was not selling it, but he always kept it as a backup crop because sometimes wheat would do well and sometimes it wouldn't do well. Sometimes corn would do well, but he was kind of growing a variety. He was considered and described by Thomas Jefferson as the best farmer in America, and he was very experimental. People tend to know that aspect of Thomas Jefferson's life, but they do not know how deeply Madison was also involved in trying different crops, corresponding with hosts of people, both up and down the Eastern Seaboard, but also internationally. He never was wildly successful, though, and there's a lot of aspects to it, including market prices. There was a many-year drought. There was infestation of insects and rust. They really struggled with agriculture, but he always kept his finger on it. Even the entire time that he and Dolly were living in Washington, D.C., he's sending very detailed instructions back here to the plantation. One of the things I've been so fascinated by is he talks about people being planters and people being farmers in his time period. And planters were the people planting tobacco, plantations. And people who were farmers were actually growing the wheat and the corn and the livestock crops. So I think they were even themselves differentiating how they were viewing each other by the crops that they were growing at that time period. You do see Madison quite poetically describing a world that he hopes does not come to pass, where the great trees are all gone and the soils are depleted, and talking also about the loss of kind of wildlife in the landscape at that time period. So I hope we're being true. I think we're being true to Madison's vision.
Well, Kat Imhoff, thank you very much for telling us about your efforts today to preserve the future. Any final thoughts before we go?
No, I just hope that you get to see a red-headed woodpecker on property at some point yourself.
I'm getting my binoculars out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to both of our guests, Tony Seaton of Johnson City, Tennessee, and Kat Imhoff, the president of Montpelier. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.